is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
Welcome to the PT Pintcast. The next episode starts right now. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. On the show today, graduated magna cum laude with his DPT with an emphasis in manual therapy from the University of St. Augustine, where he was awarded the Professional Promise Award. Previously, graduated magna cum laude with his Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science degree with an emphasis in strength and conditioning from Liberty University, and he interned with the Naval Medical Center of San Diego, specializing in vestibular rehab of the tactical athlete, as well as Duke University Healthcare System, specializing in sports medicine. He has held teaching positions for the Functional Movement System, that's FMS, Equinox Fitness Training Institute, and Liberty University. Currently, he operates Mountain River Therapy, located at FMS headquarters in Virginia, and he's adjunct faculty and the athletic training at Lynchburg College. Welcome to the PT Pintcast, Don Reagan. Don, welcome to the show, man.
Jimmy, thank you so much for having me. And let me just say that I really like what you're doing with this this whole podcast. I think it's awesome.
Well, cool. This essentially is the goal, just to have cool conversations about PT, just in a relaxed environment. And, you know, talking to somebody today who asked me, are you going to keep doing it, like, after you graduate? So I graduate in August. And I said, only if I learn stuff with each episode and if I have fun. So if I'm keep doing that, then yeah, I'll keep cranking out these episodes, I think, so far. So, well, thanks for taking the time to talk, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the ways that I know that I'm in the right industry and the right profession, is that I really love hearing from, connecting with, and learning from my colleagues. And I've had a chance to listen to a few of your episodes, and I've really enjoyed them.
Cool. Thank you very much. So we kind of, before I forget, today is the first day of CSM, flying out there currently. This is being recorded a little bit beforehand, but I'm holding a pint glass filled with a New Belgium Side Trip, going with the Belgian style pale ale from New Belgium and their Side Trip. But it's in a glass that has our logo on it and some of our sponsors. So we're going to be giving them away at CSM. So if you're listening to this as you're flying and traveling to CSM, or you're at CSM and taking a listen to us, make sure to bother me on social media at PT Pintcast, and I will get you a pint glass, because we're bringing a bunch of them out there. And we'll be giving them away all during the combined sections meeting. So now that the hard stuff's out of the way, let's get to the fun stuff. So we kind of connected on Twitter, and some people had suggested me following you, and you just put some good, interesting, and I think thought-provoking, which is usually what I think a tweet should be. It should provoke thought, or at least link to a thought. And you had kind of shared a video, which was kind of a Cliff's Notes. Is that like a good way to say it? A Cliff's Notes version of a book, kind of a summation. And the book summation was Mastery by Robert Greene. And it was done in a really, really good way. I'm going to put the link up on our website, ptpintcast.com, in case you want to see that too, because I watched a couple of this guy's videos. And it was all about the journey towards mastery. And what does that mean? Because I think some of those terms get thrown around a lot, especially on Twitter. But what does it actually mean? What does it mean to you?
Well, I think mastery is a phenomenal word. It's something that I've been studying for intensely for the last few years. Initially, I used the word greatness, you know, that I was pursuing greatness in my career and in my profession. But I have since substituted the word mastery, because I think the word greatness is something that's bestowed upon you. I don't think that's something that can self-proclaim. And so mastery to me is simply the combination of skill and creativity.
In the book by Robert Greene, he puts a third part in there, which I think is actually kind of applicable, especially to PT students going out for their first clinical rotation. That was observation. He kind of highlights making sure that when you're beginning this road to mastery, this journey towards mastery, as they put it, you just observe first, and you try not to insert your maybe preconceived opinions. And he kind of put it even more bluntly by saying, don't just walk in there to a situation. And of course, I put myself in a clinical situation as I was listening to this guy. Don't walk into a clinical situation and kind of assert, well, this is what I read, and this is the video that I saw, so this is the best evidence, this is what I should do. Just observe was kind of the author's suggestion. Observe first and gather, just take everything in. Maybe you're never going to do it like your CI is showing you right now, but just take it in and learn from that. So that was first, then was that skill, which, I mean, people have said, you know, to actually master something, there's, you know, 10,000 hours of practicing. And then, of course, that creativity element that leads to that mastery.
Absolutely. I think that was a mistake that I made on the first few of my interviews coming out of PT school, was I was so ambitious and excited to talk about my passion and my interests, and particularly combining the diagnostic skills of a physical therapist with the principles and the application of strength and conditioning, that I would go on a PT position interview and I would find myself talking a lot about why isn't this practice using kettlebells or a barbell, or, you know, why what does end stage rehab look like for you guys and your return to play criteria, instead of being more observant and humble and sort of that maybe the open vessel to receive information input.
Yeah.
I was more interested in kind of advocating for what I think the future of physical therapy, particularly sports type of physical therapy, is going to be in the future. That closed a couple of doors for me, which retrospectively, I think youthful hubris on
right.
my part.
Yeah, I think it comes off, or it can come off as cocky, and it can be cocky, but it can also be you just being eager to show, hey, I spent the time to learn this, and I want to show you what I've learned. I want to show you how forward thinking I am. But, you know, the author of the book, you know, Master, was kind of hinting at what can kind of come off, and it can socially isolate you.
Exactly.
So they kind of focused on making sure you have this kind of social intelligence of, do you want to get it right or be right? So just
right.
because you're kicking in the door and you're saying, I've got the best evidence, you might want to just hold that back a little bit, and maybe you'd learn something more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think coming into that interview or into that first exposure, you know, without having some secret agenda, you know, I kind of felt like I had, you know, and thinking back on it, I think I had a bit of an agenda. Like, I really wanted to show people that having a CSCS strength and conditioning background was really the future of orthopedic and sports medicine PT, and that the profession needs to embrace that. But without actually knowing what being a PT meant or how to truly practice, I was a couple steps ahead of where I needed to be. So now, as I'm in clinic and I've been out of school for over 5 years, that I have created a mentoring clinic, a teaching clinic, where I've had approximately 10 PT students in the past couple of years and approximately 25 students altogether, different sorts, athletic training, strength and conditioning. I've had a few physicians, I had an orthopedic surgeon shadow me for a while, and those experiences have really helped me to consolidate my ideas, my thoughts on mastery and how to encourage and sort of help students with this process. And that's why Robert Greene's book was so profound for me, was because he lays out in almost a real systematic template of what it means to become a master and how to do it. And what I really liked about it is that he submits that it's not about your industry. It's not about your particular passion or profession, that there's really this almost algorithm to mastery that everyone has to go through. And he submits all of these different experts in various fields that hit a couple of key points. And that's really what I wanted to share with our community, our profession, with your audiences, a couple of these points, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So the first one that I really like, he says in the book, is follow your inclination. And this is something that I've noticed my students in general have struggled with, sort of the fight, the internal struggle between the rational mind and the intuitive mind. And by that, you know, consider, there's a book I really like about this. It's called Switch by Chip and Dan Heath, and they talk about this in an analogy of a mouse riding an elephant. And they say that the mouse is a rational mind. That's the mind that has all the fear, the anxiety about paying back your student loans, and
right.
you know, was PT the right choice for you?
Right.
Are you going to be able to tolerate Medicare and workers' comp or all of those, you know, disgruntled patients? And are you ever going to get respect from the community? And then there's the elephant, which is, you know, the intuitive mind. That's really about kind of the passion and what got you into this in the first place. And unfortunately, that rational mind seems to dominate the intuitive mind. And so I find myself encouraging my students do the introspection to really figure out what makes them excited, what really motivates them to pursue a particular career choice or particular environment or patient population. And what I find more often than not is that a lot of my students, especially the younger ones, they haven't done that hard work of laying the foundation for why they're getting into a particular profession. For example, a really classic example of this is when an undergrad comes to shadow and they say to me, well, I can't decide if I want to go to PT school or PA school. When someone says that, I mean, I know right offhand the conversation I need to have, which is really about, you know, who are you?
Right.
What motivates you? Because in my mind, PT and PA are very different career choices.
All right. I just want to say we haven't had this conversation beforehand, but I was dead set on PT school, and a friend of the family who is an orthopedic surgeon suggested PA school, and it made me think, well, maybe I should. And he put forth, and I think I know what you're getting at, in that summation of Robert Greene's book, they talked about somebody who wants to be a composer, and then it gets convinced to become a doctor, and it gets right. that rational mind turned on and gets that right. creative mind turned off. And I thought about it, and I walked around for a couple weeks saying, maybe I should go to PA school. And then eventually I literally had a friend say, we can see the fact that you're a PT. We can see that. You're not a PA. But to me, it was, well, maybe I'd make more money, or maybe I'd be more happy. And right. that's the wrong reason to do anything.
Absolutely. 100%. You know, I thought about osteopathy school. I thought about chiropractic school. I thought about strength and conditioning. I mean, I knew I was in the right industry, like a lot of people. I knew I wanted to help people, but I wasn't real sure on how I wanted to help those people.
Right.
And so whenever a student says that, I'm like, you know, really? You know, just because they're a similar amount of education
right.
and you don't have to, you know, go through the long process of medical school, you know, that's not the right motivation. And so I find myself really encouraging students to perform, you know, the effort, put the effort into figuring out what really makes them tick, what inspires them, what is exciting for them, you know, because work is hard. You know, I think we forget that in academia, you know, when you have holidays off and summers off, when you commit to a career choice and you get into work, that, I mean, it's 5 days a week, mm-hmm. every week, 50 weeks a year. It's hard. It's hard work. And if you're not really inspired and motivated to be there, because a lot of people in our culture are not in the right place for them, it's just a terrible place to be.
Can be a long day, man. If you don't like it, it's a long day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't care what medical field, you know, or healthcare field that you get into, it's all hard. All these jobs are hard. There's pros and cons to all of it. You have to make sure that your excitement, your enthusiasm, your passion is going to outweigh the cons of that career choice, because there's going to be cons, you know, whether it's documentation or it's a particular patient population, you know, whatever the con is for you, maybe being in one place for 40 hours a week. You know, I found that to be challenging sometimes.
Yeah.
Just being in the same environment for that long. You know, I have to find creative ways to stay engaged. So the idea of following your inclination, you know, that was profound for me.
Okay.
I know that my inclination, what my passion was, I was a sophomore in high school, and my PE teacher owned a gym. I begged for a job there. I'd always been infatuated with strength training and human performance, and got a job in that gym, and that was it. I was so excited. I was ready to, you know, kind of work in that gym for the rest of my life. I wasn't going to go to college, and I was just excited to be in the weight room. And that was my first real passion, that I knew this is my home. This is where I belong. And that eventually carried me, you know, through a bachelor's degree and a graduate degree. But that's something that I'm always kind of trying to get back, you know, working with people who have an athletic ambition, or, you know, they respect the weight room and they respect human performance. I love those types of clients. I love those types of students. And I enjoy being in a clinical environment where I am now, where we have a barbell, we have heavy kettlebells, we do some performance enhancement. It's really, really fun.
Yeah, that's a good tenet, I think, to start with, is follow your inclination, because I think it sets you in the right mindset of why am I about to make this decision. And you can kind of check yourself, really, before you wreck yourself with any decision that you're going to make in terms of your career, where you're going to get a job, what setting you're going to be in, or just decisions with patients down the road. Is, am I making this decision because of which mind, the rational mind or the creative mind?
Exactly.
All right. So that's the first tenet, follow your inclination. What's up next?
The next one is apprenticeship.
Okay.
And, you know, I think the first step is critical. It's so important. But the second step is really important as well. And in our profession, in the medical industry, you know, we've really put residency and fellowship as apprenticeship process. And unfortunately, that wasn't a route that I was able to do. But luckily for me, I was really blessed with the opportunity as I moved back to Virginia to be in close proximity to Gray Cook. He and I developed a collegial relationship. He sent me a few patients. I sent him a few patients. And eventually a position opened up in his facility for me to go and apprentice with him. And by apprentice, what I mean is my first year there, we co-evaluated and co-treated 1 to 1.5 days a week for a year. And like Robert Greene said, I didn't go into those days and go, okay, well, I'm going to show Gray what I know and what I can do.
Right.
Most of the time, I'd say 90, 95% of the time, it was me being quiet and listening to him, watching him. the way he'd communicate with patients, the way that he would interact, the way that he would explain a plan of care, the way that he would do some dry needling or manipulation or taping or exercise was just, it was awesome. My mind was blown. I would encourage anyone that's struggling with burnout or they're trying to figure out the quickest way to become as good as they possibly can is that you've got to go and find somebody that's doing what you want to do that it literally infatuates you. The way that Gray practices and the way that Gray describes his practice and the industry in general, it's just, I've always really enjoyed hearing his thoughts and found his style of practice to be really infatuating. That's probably the best word for it. He's one of the few people that have agreed with him on so many levels, both before I knew him as a colleague, and then even now as we practice together. There's just so many things that he'll do, and he'll come at it from a different direction and say, hey, what do you think about this? And I'll go, man, I haven't thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate that type of atmosphere and interaction. So finding an apprenticeship is so important, and it's not about what you have to offer necessarily. I think you need to show up humble, open, and ready to learn, and be exposed to a creative way of practice.
Yeah,
because again, mastery, right? It's about the combination of skill and creativity. In our profession, we think that means the more letters you have, the better you are.
Or alphabet soup,
right? Where you graduated from school, or the residency, or the fellowship, and all those things are great. And I certainly don't want to come across like I'm talking down about those things. I'd love to have those things myself, but I will say that for me, I got so much better as a clinician being around a master clinician for a couple of years, and I can't emphasize that enough. It was truly an awesome experience. Even if it's not Gray Cook, someone that has the reputation that he has, but if it's just somebody who has been practicing for 20 years and that they're operating at a level that they're thinking at a level that just really you think is awesome, that just inspires you, go do whatever it takes to be around that person at whatever capacity you can. And if that means moving, if that means taking a pay cut, whatever that means, I would encourage all of our audience and all of our colleagues to go and do that.
Yeah.
Whether that means getting engaged for the first time or getting re-engaged, it's so, so important to do that.
Well, I think that there's two components to that and making it successful, and you can do it with a residency or fellowship. I think that's what a lot of PT students are scared of is leaving and not getting that apprenticeship. So that we kind of cling. We say, well, we'll get signed up for this residency and I'll get that. And I think you do, but I think you can also get it from what you had just mentioned, which was two things. Number one, somebody who you respect and someone who you deem as intelligent and you like the way they practice. And number two, somebody you get along with, someone who you communicate well with. And that's a match made in heaven right there.
It is. It is. And I think it's important for the students to also hear this, that, all of your potential first-time employers, they all know that you guys are, competent, but not necessarily as proficient as you want to be.
Right.
And so they're gonna use that word mentorship. We have a mentoring program. We have an in-house residency. All those types of terminology to sell you on that first job.
Right.
And let me encourage you that when you're looking for that first job or you're looking to make a job switch, connect with the clinician that you're going to be side by side with the most. Build some relationship with them. Ask them hard questions. Connect with them, because if they're hesitant, recalcitrant, if they're not interested in maybe having those conversations with you, then that's probably not a place that I'd
bad sign.
Work.
So let me ask you this then, keeping that frame of mind, looking for my first job, and you're saying that a lot of clinicians are looking to use it as a selling point because a lot of new grads want that. What are some good questions that I can ask that I can kind of weed out the places that are or are not actually going to back up what they're claiming?
I think one of the first things I found myself telling this to a student recently is when you go on their website and you're looking at their staff, try to not get infatuated or carried away with the letters and the training. But look for how many years has that staff member been a part of that organization?
Okay, so like retention.
Yeah, because I find that attrition is really a bad sign.
It means that
the organization is not really well led. It means that there's a reason why clinicians are coming and going at a high rate. Other things, how they provide continuing education.
That's a big one, yeah.
How they facilitate teamwork, communication. Leadership is a really big piece for me, especially in private practice. I think we have a paucity of really skilled leaders in healthcare in general. Maybe it's just energy. Like, how much energy is this potential employer investing in you, and not just, you know, here's the job description and here's our package. Are they really interested in getting to know you, your desires and your ambitions and your goals? One thing that I think really concerns me about private practice in particular is how people are really concerned about investing in a new grad or in a young clinician, and then in a few years they jump ship. So they make them sign non-compete clauses, or they find ways to sort of kind of trap them into their job, so to speak. And I just think that's another really like unhealthy sign. There's a mutual symbiotic relationship between the employer and the employee where, you know, there's respect both ways. It's reciprocal. Both parties are benefiting from the relationship. Once one side of the party doesn't feel benefit, that's when complacency, you know, starts to creep in, especially with organizations that are really focused on profit. Eventually, the employees become devalued and disengaged, and then micromanagement has to happen, those clinicians to do their job.
I had that experience in radio with non-compete clauses, and the way I always looked at it is, man, if you continually make this a place that I want to work, I'm never going to leave. You'll have to force me out of here. But if you lock me in, that makes me wonder, if you're locking me in, there's a reason I'm going to want to leave soon.
Right.
And I understand it from both sides. You know, a lot of students do come out of school, take that first job, and then a year or two in, start looking around. Maybe this was a bad decision. Maybe it needs to start earlier with pick the right student, and the student should pick the right clinic, and you won't need a non-compete clause at all.
Yeah, let's just have real relationship. Let's have real conversation. Let's be honest and transparent about it. I think the same thing happens a lot with clinical rotations, in the academic setting. I mean, I think we need to do a better job in our profession of connecting the right student with the right CI and the right clinical experience. And I'm sure that's a really hard job, and I don't do that job. I'm on the other end, but mm-hmm. I perform a thorough screening process for all of my student applicants. And I know other really good CIs, good clinical locations that do the same thing, because I've turned students down. You know, it wasn't the right fit. They wanted to get out of school and be in a skilled nursing facility.
Right.
You know, that's great. Well, you know, go somewhere and do that. Go learn from somebody who's really passionate about that, but that's not me. You know, I think the same thing happens in our first job is the veterans in our profession. It's their responsibility to be transparent and honest with new grads, in my opinion, to be fair to them and say, hey, look, this is truth. Like, this is how we really handle mentorship. You know, this is how we do Con Ed, and this is really what to expect. But in my experience, a lot of my interviews and courting relationships with potential employers, I guess there was just, it felt like there was misdirection. I'm going to say that employers were lying to me, but you know, I think there were areas in the package, so to speak, or in what they presented that wasn't really as truthful or as accurate as, you know, actual practice
right.
in their environment really was.
Right. Yeah. I mean, landing a job shouldn't be like, you know, a contest. It shouldn't be like The Bachelor. Like, you just want to win at all costs. I want to get this job. Why? I don't know, because this is where I want to work. This is the setting. This is what's open. I don't want to win a job. I want to find a fit. I think right. There's a huge difference there, you know? I don't know why I bring up The Bachelor. I think that show just makes me, you know, nauseous, probably because it's a chick show, but also because it just shows you want to win at all costs. Is this the right guy to marry? Is this the right clinic to get a job at? I don't know, but this is the one in front of me, so I want to win. Right. But it's hard to turn that down, especially when you'd be going to school for a gajillion years and you got $100,000 in debt or more, and you're saying, I need a job, and this one pays pretty well. I want to land this one, but you could be miserable 6 months from now.
Right. So again, that's the struggle between the intuitive mind
right.
and the rational mind. And you know, I just think it's really important to get your career the right trajectory is to listen to that intuition. You know, what's your gut reaction? When you walk into a clinic for the first time, you know, when you meet your potential supervisor or, you know, your potential colleague, what is your gut response? You know, what happens? And now the mistake that I'm proclaiming to the world that I made was I made my gut response a little too public. You know, I was a little bit too
right.
open or bold about that. Pay attention to that intuition. You know, what is the first feel you get when you walk into that clinical environment? You know, when you look into the patient's eyes, are they engaged? Are they excited to be there? Are the clinicians really inspired? Do they practice what they preach? Are they
right.
they really engaged? I do think that there's this weird courtship when you're looking for a job, and I do think there's misinformation, especially for the new graduate. It pains me to talk to a new grad in their first job, and they're like, you know, this isn't what I expected. I didn't know I'd have to work Saturdays, or I didn't know that I had to work undulating shifts, or I didn't know that they were going to hand me protocols for common diagnoses like back pain. I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was, you know, going to be this much documentation. And, you know, and I think that's what facilitates a really good match is when the individual, the employee, knows exactly what they're getting themselves into, and the employer the same. And I think having true conversation and relationship over that is what will facilitate good connections.
Right. Yeah, I'd like to be found, or I'd like to be accepted by or hired by the right clinic and not necessarily the first or second or third. Maybe because this is my second career and I did radio for a while, I'm almost okay with someone saying, no, you're not the right fit. I almost want to say thank you for, you know, saving 6 months or a year of my life.
Exactly.
Not fitting in. I'm cool with that.
Right. But because there's a shortage, or there's, I guess there's a lot of competition, I never hear of that, you know, of employers just saying, you know, you're not the right fit, because there, a lot of employers are hungry for a license.
Right.
I just need a license that bills the insurance. You know, even if they don't have the skill set, you know, I'm going to, you know, I can train them up to be competent in our system. Or maybe their system has such infrastructure that literally they just need a license.
Because just a body.
Yeah, because they need to follow the protocol. And I've also heard this on the other end of the spectrum, with seasoned veteran clinicians who want to make a change in geography, and they have a hard time finding a job because the employers in that community don't want someone who's that, you know, well qualified or credentialed. Maybe they don't want somebody coming into their practice with new ideas or challenging the status quo.
Rocking the boat.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting paradigm shift, you know, on the other end of the professional spectrum, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, that's something to definitely look out. All the suggestions that you're giving right there about questions to ask makes me want to put together a list and put it on our website, like almost like a checklist of things that, you know, myself as the student looking for the job should make sure I ask, so I don't get caught somewhere I shouldn't be, or we get caught somewhere where we shouldn't be. But maybe that's something I should definitely start writing down, is things to make sure to ask on your first PT job interview.
It's a great concept, great idea. But I know for me, I probably asked too many questions, or I asked hard questions. And that's why a few of my interviews, I didn't just not get a job offer. A couple of my interviews, I didn't even get like a call back. Like, I had to pursue them to just kind of see, well, what's your decision?
Right.
And they were like, oh yeah, you're definitely not our guy. Okay, thanks. You know, like, why? You know, what did I do wrong?
Right.
Or, you know, what was the problem? And, you know, I didn't really get, you know, real helpful feedback.
So. Yeah, you had mentioned that you kind of wear in your thoughts and feelings on the field and where it should go on your chest. And maybe that was a bad thing. It got some people turned off, but maybe it just saved you some time in the long run. I'm not advocating for people going there with guns blazing, but they should at least be honest, and at least be honest before they sign and take the job, because that can save you some time.
Sure. Well, that was my perspective. On my end, it was like, well, here, this is who I am, and this is my vision. This is what I want to do with my career, and that's going to involve heavy weights and Atlas stones and kettlebells and, you know, like that kind of stuff. And, you know, if this is the type of orthopedic clinic that, you know, we're not going to do strength and conditioning or performance type stuff, then I'm just not your guy.
Yeah, I'm sensing not a lot of yellow TheraBand work with you.
Yeah, and that's something I'm really proud of, is that when you come to our clinic, there is no TheraBand in sight. We use surgical tubing, but TheraBand is in a box in room 3, and we sparingly give that out for home exercise programs occasionally, or actually as compression wrap. I think we use it more for compression wrap than anything else at this point.
All right, next tenet on our journey towards mastery. What's up?
The next concept, and this isn't so much from Robert Greene, but just something that I've learned in my career that I share with my students a lot, is a simple formula that relationships and results, or plus results, equals success. And I think this is important, because I've had students, you know, on different ends of the spectrum that are all about results. And by results, what I mean by that is like, it's the science. It's the kind of the application of the textbook information, or what you learn in a Con Ed course, or what you learn in school. And so getting objective results is so important. It's very important. But then some of those students really struggle with the interpersonal skills, or the emotional intelligence to connect and build rapport and obtain buy-in. And then I've had students on the other end of the spectrum that just naturally have high levels of emotional intelligence. They connect with patients. Patients love them, but their assessment and diagnostic skills are found lacking. What I've found is that the combination of the two is so critical in our career of being successful. And Robert Greene does talk about that, about emotional intelligence,
right?
And that, you know, we need to be sensitive to that, because there does come a point in your apprenticeship where you have to sort of break free from that. For example, you know, you just kind of get to a place where, you know, you need to spread your own wings and you need to do your own thing. And there was definitely a place in clinic with Gray and I where there was a point where it was like, okay, Gray, like I got this. Like I need to take control. I need to lead this practice. I can't have patients constantly coming in going, where's Gray? Where's Gray? I want to see Gray. He, you know, respectfully kind of bowed out and stepped out of the clinic and let me take over. And he's still there, you know, when I need him to consult, or I'll reference him, you know, for some ideas or some feedback. And then occasionally we still do co-evaluate and co-treat clients, usually VIP type folks. But that was important for me, is kind of realizing that for me personally, relationships came very easily, just like exercise came really easy to me, as, you know, looking at movement, looking at exercise, coaching exercise, those things came easy to me. I've had to put a lot of effort into learning a clinical framework of test and retest and really measuring quantifiable pattern dysfunction or impairment dysfunction and getting results, just like I've had to put a lot of effort into developing my hands. Manual therapy, whether that's dry needling or manipulation, I've had to put a lot of energy into that. What I find is that a lot of folks in our industry, they get stuck with doing what they're good at, what comes natural to them. I think we all have a proclivity to one or the other, you know, either relationships or, you know, measuring results, or another example is exercise versus manual therapy. It's so important that whichever one comes natural, you know, appreciate that and enjoy that, but work intently with focus on developing the other skill set, you know, whatever you diagnose that to be in your own practice. And that's what, you know, having apprenticeship and having mentors in your life, it's what's so important about that, is getting that feedback. You know, like, for example, maybe you're a really good communicator, you develop relationship and rapport very well, but you can't manipulate a cervical spine. If you can't do that and you see a lot of spines, that's a skill that you should consider developing.
I was going to ask that, you just kind of read my mind. So relationship and results, the relationship and skill, which one, if you were lacking, would be harder to learn? Like, which one is better to have naturally? Is there one, or can you just learn both?
Yeah, in my opinion, I think relationship is harder to learn. I think the emotional intelligence piece is harder to learn. In my PT class, there were a few folks in our class that I think they just naturally had that gift. They were warm, they were welcoming, they were hospitable, they were so comfortable to be around. And those were the people that you were like, man, if my mom needed therapy, that's who I would send her to. Even if, you know, I wasn't real confident in their skills, I know that person would be genuine and caring, compassionate, and honest. I think that is an innate ability. And I do believe it's, you can improve it. You can learn it. Being aware of it is the first step. But I think skill is much easier to learn than emotional intelligence.
Gotcha. Well, I think it's good to pay attention to the fact that there are two things that come into play for a formula of success, and that's coming in terms of, you know, outcomes, but also what the patient deems as a good, successful treatment session or course of treatment.
Sure. It's really like thinking about the subjective and objective component of a note, or signs and symptoms. You know, these are all different ways of saying the same thing, that you know, there's a qualitative and a quantitative aspect to clinical interaction. You've got to be competent at minimum at both, proficiency at both. Being really good at both is what makes someone, in my opinion, a master physical therapist.
Well, that's the third tenet right there. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about why your Twitter feed is actually named Carpe Diem. I want to know the story. There's got to be a story behind that. So I want to get into that. I want to talk more about the journey towards mastery and lifelong learning, plus assess and reassess. It's something you had tweeted out recently. I want to get into that when we come back with Don Regan on the PT Pinecast. Don't move.
Taking IPAs over TKAs. It's the PT Pinecast. It's time for the PT Final Exam Pop Quiz. Here's today's question.
Can you share NPTE items after you take your exam? Question is, can you share NPTE items after you take your examination?
We'll be right back with the answer of today's PT Final Exam Pop Quiz. The PT Pinecast proudly supports Enable. Enable is a global network of volunteers who use 3D printers, design skills, and personal time to create free 3D printed prosthetic hands for those in need. The hands are provided free of charge to underserved populations around the world. Enable is not a company and does not sell these devices. They are a network of people. If you are in need of a hand or would like to be part of Enable, visit them online at enablingthefuture.com. Okay, here's today's PT Final Exam Pop Quiz one more time.
can you share NPTE items after you take your exam? Question is, can you share NPTE items after you take your examination?
And the answer to the PT final exam pop quiz is...
No, absolutely not. No, with big exclamation points. Items from the examination cannot be shared with any person for any reason. So, word to the wise, keep it clean, no cheating. Don't share any of those exam items after you take the NPTE.
Remember, for your NPTE test prep, all you need is the PT Final Exam. Find them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. This is the PT Pintcast.
We are back on the PT Pintcast. I do want to make sure you can get a hold of him if you like what you're hearing, and just follow him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Don Regan. That's at DonReagan. But your Twitter feed is actually listed as Carpe Diem. Seize the day. I'm guessing there's got to be a story there.
There's really two references. The first is really kind of funny. I'm a Metallica fan.
Yeah.
You know, probably just the kind of the weight room background. And so there's a song in the album Reload called Carpe Diem Baby. Couldn't really tell you what much of the rest of the lyrics are, but I just like that song. I ended up using the Reload sort of logo or the album cover for a talk I did for the North Carolina Physical Therapy Association a few years ago. It's just something I really like. And then the other reference is from a Robin Williams movie. It's the one where he's a teacher. I can't remember.
Dead
Poets Society. And he talks about, you know, seize the day. And I find that to be inspirational. And so it's just something that kind of helps me. I hashtag that a lot and just helps to remind me sort of what I'm in this for and you know, why I'm, you know, doing my best every day.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the Metallica album. I'm a former rock radio DJ. I'd be remiss not to mention a couple other good songs in that album that you should check out. Memory Remains, Fuel, Unforgiven 2. There's some good ones on there. Reload.
Oh, yeah.
Undervalued, but it's a good one.
Yep.
All right. So we want to get back into the PT talk now that we're done talking about Metallica. Mentors. That's the next tenet in terms of your journey towards mastery, or something we should keep in focus when we're looking to master this thing that we call PT. So what does that mean to you, or how does that fit into the equation?
It's important to seek mentorship in all areas of your life, and that's something that I do regularly. I think your mentors will recycle. You'll have mentors at, you know, one stage in your life, and then, you know, maybe you move on and get to a different place or a different mentor. I think they come and go. Basically, to define a mentorship, the relationship is bilateral and it's candid, it's transparent. This is somebody that you're going to be real with. You're going to be open and honest with, like, whatever you're struggling with in practice. Maybe you're a fellow of AOMT, but you're not comfortable manipulating the spine. Or maybe you're an OCS. You know, you don't know how to do some technique that, you know, you feel like, you know, you should know how to do that. Well, you know, maybe that mentor is somebody that, you know, you feel comfortable. Like, you're not going to put it on social media, but, you know, you feel comfortable kind of going to your mentor and saying, hey, will you help me with this? Because I struggle with the multi-lever thrust manipulation for the cervical spine.
That relationship is important. I see it in class. We've got a student who will remain nameless who is notorious for raising his hand and asking a lot of questions in class. And sometimes it annoys people because he does ask quite a few questions. But he's honest enough to say in the middle of class, in front of everybody, I don't understand this. I need you to go over it again. And I think that sometimes, you know, keeping your mouth shut seems like the safe move. But in the long run, if you ask the questions, you're going to understand the topic a lot better than everybody else who keeps their mouth closed.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we have to become comfortable with the uncomfortable. Being that person, asking those questions, going to a course, a Con Ed course, that it's not something you're real excited about, but you know you need to get better at. Like, for example, differential diagnosis is one that I know I want to get better at. I need to get better at. You know, when I read those course descriptions, maybe I just don't get as excited about that course as I do something else. I think we need to get comfortable with that. You know, part of being in an apprenticeship or soliciting and finding mentorship is that you have to be comfortable with that type of candor, that type of relationship. And that's not comfortable. There's nothing comfortable about being in an exam room with Gray Cook and coming out of the room and him going, okay, did you screen neuro? Did you do this? Did you do that? And be like, nope, I forgot. And then he looks down on me like, don't ever miss neuro again. And you know what? I don't miss neuro anymore. I do neuro screens every day.
And that's the reason why, is you kind of, you had that a little bit of adrenaline rush and it burned an imprint into your brain of that was important, but sometimes we need that. And being able to be honest with a mentor and admit your faults is really difficult, but really, really important.
Absolutely.
Well, cool. That's our journey to mastery. I'm actually going to post that video that you had sent. It's almost like a Cliff's Notes. I mean, if you want to read some of these great books, you should. But if you want to just kind of hit the Cliff's Notes, this guy does a really, really great job telling the story with some good visuals. So we'll post that online at ptpinecast.com.
Sure. And I love his handle. I think it's Fighting Mediocrity.
Yeah, Fighting Mediocrity on YouTube.
Love that.
Yeah, dude, he's got a cool thing going on, and I'll definitely share that. So more with Don, lifelong learning for PT students and practicing PTs. Just being, I'm using air quotes right now, in PT, and I'm still in PT school right now, for 3 years, I see a lot of ads and a lot of different people selling continuing education classes and different things I should take. It makes me as a PT student nervous that as soon as I get out there, I need to start taking classes immediately. So lifelong learning is something people stress upon PTs as we head out into the field. But how do we avoid getting caught up in the fads? Because different things come and go. It's hard to navigate and they aren't necessarily cheap.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I think it's a valid one. You know, firstly, I think we all need to recognize that continuing education as an industry is very lucrative, and that there's a reason why people, you know, are fighting and you know, scrambling to be the best taping, you know, course or movement course or manual therapy course. Because, you know, if you've got 20 people in a room and they all paid $1,000 for the day, that's a lot of money. It's a lot more money in one day teaching than you could make in a clinic. And so I think it's important that we keep our eyes open about that. I will say that for me personally, that I have consistently learned so much more by going to shadow somebody in their context, in their world, treating their people, than I've ever learned at a workshop or a conference or a course.
You point out shadowing. What you get there is one-on-one. What you get is a patient right in front of you, and you get to see him use it, and you get to ask the question one-on-one. Again, not knocking Con Ed. I've taken a couple courses even as a PT student, and they're great, but sometimes raising your hand in the middle of class is difficult. But if you're one-on-one, man, that's valuable.
Oh, I just think there's so many nuances that you pick up from watching an expert do something with a, you know, a real live client, and the way they communicate and their body language. And there's so much to learn. And then I think maybe another important thing to emphasize is, you know, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a PT, right? That, you know, going to shadow other disciplines is so valuable, and not just orthopedic surgeons because we're trying to get the referrals, you know, a massage therapist or a chiropractor or an occupational therapist or a personal trainer or a strength coach. There's so much out there to learn, and there's so many smart people that I think that's an aspect of continuing education that I don't think we value enough, is taking a day off to sort of recharge from your practice and just go across town, you know, to the person that you've heard is getting results, and people, you know, go to that person because they're good, and just go shadow them, you know, develop a collegial relationship. You know, we don't do this in private practice enough because everyone's so busy trying to compete with one another,
right,
and make a profit.
Right. Yeah.
And so we have to fly across the country to take a course so that, you know, no one feels threatened that, you know, I'm going to come back to my town with, you know, or I'm going to learn from my, you know, my competitor, and they're going to steal my ideas and steal my patients. You know, we've got to get past that. Hoarding information and hoarding patients. Everyone talks about quality of care, and you know, all the websites say that this practice is in it for the quality of care. But then when you actually watch their practice patterns and how they make decisions and how patients feel from the experience, that's not actually what happens, because actions are always more important and valuable and louder than words.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can write anything you want on a website, but what actually happens in your clinic when the patients walk in, that's the
right
difference. And you can see that if you do something like shadowing. And I kind of like that advice of shadowing somebody outside of PT. I'll be honest, I hadn't really thought of that.
Absolutely. I've been really blessed to have different professionals come and shadow in the clinic here in Sova, from strength coaches to orthopedic surgeons to primary care physicians to lots of PTs and a couple chiros. And that has been, it's been awesome. I vividly remember a few months ago treating a local chiropractor, and just, you know, he's in the room and he's paying me for my services. And I'm just like, you know, hey doc, can you help me with this, you know, spinal manipulation? Can you help me maybe against perhaps some professional boundaries? He did. And he was so cool about it. And he was like, well, you know, here's what you need to do better. And here's what you need to change. And I just, I found that to be so helpful. And I thought that was super cool. And then he's planning on coming to the clinic to observe me doing some dry needling because he wants to add that to his practice. And I think that type of collegial relationship, we need more of that, both within the profession and then with other professions.
That's cool. That's a cool way to look at it. I like that, man.
So as far as coursework, Con Ed, I think there are too many Con Ed junkies that they just jump from course to course and get more letters behind their name until eventually it doesn't fit on their business card. I think what's happening again is going back to the intuitive mind and introspection is that they're not doing enough introspection or getting enough feedback from their patients or their colleagues to say, hey, I think you're really good at this, but you need to get better at that. And then choosing to take the course, the appropriate course for their need. I think that's one area, you know, is that, you know, getting hopped up on courses may not necessarily be what you need. So how do you even know what you need? I spend a lot of my energy and funds early on in my career trying to understand these words in PT school that confounded me, primarily these words, evaluation, assessment, diagnosis, and prognosis. Those words, although they were big, trisyllabic, I knew they were important. They were in the guide to PT practice, but I didn't really understand what they meant, and I didn't really understand how they were different. And so I spent a lot of my energy trying to figure those words out. How do I become a better evaluator and diagnostician? And that's why I embraced functional movement systems. It was a clinical framework that just made sense to me. I really appreciated kind of the upright loaded assessments and then the table assessments and active versus passive and end feels and the qualitative and quantitative approach. And there's lots of different clinical frameworks. And I think you just got to pick one. Really focus on assessment and diagnosis. You know, Vladimir Yanda has a great quote about time spent in assessment saves time in treatment. Become the best diagnostician that you can become. And then take methods classes after that. Because actually, what I found in my career is that when I'm in the right area, when I'm doing the right treatment for the person, the actual intervention is not that hard. It's not that complicated. If we're putting all this emphasis and energy into the methods or the treatment, then you're probably doing it wrong. Basically, what you're doing is you're treating and then you're waiting for, you know, a positive result. You know, like, hey, does this work? It's a trial and error methodology. That's not the best way to learn. You know, kind of what we talked about tonight, really my journey into mastery was about trying to expedite the process. I really wanted to be as good as possible, as quickly as possible. Some of these things about following your inclination and apprenticeship and finding mentors, all of these things help me to get better faster. This Con Ed suggestion has been, I can't emphasize, I haven't been to that many courses. I really haven't. I have spent a lot of energy trying to be the best assessor that I could be in diagnostician. And then a few key interventions that I really wanted to learn and really wanted to get good at, such as dry needling, spinal manipulation. Those things, they're powerful treatments. They get results. And so they have been really helpful for me. And so in general, those would be my suggestions with Con Ed is be selective and be skeptical. You know, that's okay. I kind of like infomercials, you know, some of these Con Ed advertisements are come learn the secrets of the SI joint.
Yeah.
You're going to solve all PSIS pain for the rest of your career.
Right.
If you come and learn this osteopathic approach to the SI, and I get turned off by a lot of that. I get turned off by courses that are specifically patho-anatomical. Come learn everything there is to know about the shoulder that doesn't particularly maybe attract me. I think it really starts with the introspection. You know, cool. What do you need? And then, you know, asking around the community, you know, have you taken this course? And, you know, what'd you think? And which instructor should you take?
Right.
That's a really important one. It's not just about the manual or the website access you get afterwards. It's about the instructor. So many different instructors for different approaches. And of course, there's going to be a large variety and quality.
That's a big difference. That goes back to the relationship with the mentor is that Con Ed leader is your mentor for that particular weekend course.
True. Yeah, true. And I think thinking about apprenticeship and mentorship is those relationships, they can really help you make good decisions about Con Ed. You know, you can talk to your mentor and say, hey, did you go through this series of courses? You know, what do you think? And is this worth my time? Or can you give me the cliff notes?
Right.
And I think that's I think it's Winston Churchill that says, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. Like that idea, you know, I feel blessed in a way, stand on the shoulders of Gray. Well, first off, Gray's a lot taller than me. And so it's super cool to consider being that tall. But secondly, you know, I've learned so much from his 25-year career as a physical therapist. I've learned so much from him. And actually, a real cool story, just as a bit of a tangent, is that I got to work with and treat PTATC that was Gray's inspiration, because I work in Gray's hometown. Now, this fellow, Smitty, who's a legend in this area, he was the fifth licensed physical therapist in the state of Virginia.
Wow.
And was a war veteran at Iwo Jima, just a really awesome guy. And he was one of those people that inspired Gray to pursue PT school. And I just thought it was so cool to be able to work with one of Gray's inspirations and talk to this guy about, you know, his multiple decades in the profession. And I felt really honored to do that. And so, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, there's literally, like, when you have an apprentice and, you know, or you've done an apprenticeship, you stand on multiple shoulders to learn and to be the best that you can. I've studied under a lot of really smart people, and I feel like I stand on all of their shoulders. Stanley Paris, you know, had taken a course with him was awesome. And hearing him talk about his career was great. Mike Bergner, I spent a lot of time lifting in his home gym in Bonsall, California. I learned so much about what it meant to build relationship with your athletes and how to coach weightlifting, how to cue. Bill Gillespie is a world-class bench presser and strength coach. And, you know, I learned so much from him. And, you know, I think it's just, I feel like it's an honor to be able to, you know, mention their names as people that I stand on their shoulders.
That's a cool way to look at it. If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. That is Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the correction.
Yeah, I used that in a speech a couple years ago. I had to Google it myself. One more question and we'll let you go. You tweeted out this, and we'll frame this up as your parting shot. Each episode is a pint, but before we leave, we do shots. So the parting shot tonight is this. Assess and reassess is a model of practice that connotates thinking, feedback, and accountability, and you hashtag it with physical therapy. What's that mean to you? I just liked it. It just seemed like something I could put on the wall in a nice black and white frame. I love the fact that you went back to assess and reassess. A buddy of mine, John Tenoyles, a couple episodes ago, went to test, retest, assess, reassess. You've got to do it. And I think it's really important. How'd you land on that? Why'd you bring that up?
Because I think too many of our colleagues just treat. They mindlessly treat because we get paid to treat. I think that's unfortunate. I think that to me, that statement means permission to think. Please think in your practice. Don't give up thought. Don't give up logic. Logic is a choice. One of my colleagues in the clinic right now, Megan Babcock, you know, she said it the other day, and she said, logic is a choice. And I was like, that is profound. That is awesome. That concept, that style of practice is what has helped me make leaps and bounds towards mastery, because it sets up a clinical framework that I can check my work. It's objective. And there's a subjective piece to it as well, but I love being able to say, are you better, same, or worse? Did this help or not? You know, and if it didn't, then we need to try something else. I've never liked that idea in PT that you set up a plan of care on the evaluation and then you give it 3 or 4 weeks because you got to let the treatment settle in.
Right.
You know, what is that? I think one of the things I learned from Gray, the first few times I shadowed him before I ever eat a job, you know, the first few weeks, I think I was really amazed that Gray would walk into the exam room and he would expect to make a change in someone's movement immediately. That didn't always happen. I'm not saying that, you know, that everyone was cured on one visit, but the expectation was awesome. It was empowering to walk into the room with somebody who was like, today we're going to improve your toe touch. Today we're going to improve your prone press up. Today we're going to improve your dorsiflexion. You know, like to be able to just to come in with that type of confidence. Certainly there's a placebo effect to that, but man, I think that came from pattern recognition, you know, and testing and retesting, because you start to get better at recognizing, you know, patterns in your patients, and then you make decisions quicker.
Yeah.
You know, is this a joint problem or a soft tissue problem? How am I going to attack it?
And I think that's where students, you know, I'm not going to talk about students. I'll just talk about me. I don't want to, you know, lump other people in with my difficulties. I find that difficult too, because I haven't had the reps of someone like yourself or anybody else who's been practicing. And that's where I get a little bit nervous in terms of, that's when I just go right to treating. I'm like, I need to be doing something.
Right.
So that's
right.
I need to be doing something. I need to be moving. I need to be moving around like everybody else. Otherwise, someone's going to notice that I might not know what I'm doing for a second, or I might need a second to let that logic sink in. But I might. I do, because I haven't had the reps.
Yeah, I've noticed that in my practice, that earlier on I was so concerned about buy-in and about confidence and making sure that the patient perceived me as qualified and as an expert, that you're right, I would, you know, kind of jump into a treatment too quickly. I would make assumptions. I have noticed that as I have gotten more confident and closer to mastery, that I have been more comfortable in the exam room with pauses, you know, as I was literally thinking in front of the patient. And there's just, you know, a moment of silence where I'm thinking kind of, wow, I didn't expect that to happen. Or, where do I go from here?
Right.
I've gotten much more comfortable with that silence, just like a good teacher does. I've gotten more comfortable telling patients, I don't know. I'm not sure, but here's what we're going to do about it. Here's what I have found. And I think that if we improve this, that I think that, you know, your symptoms are going to improve as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's got to come with time and got to come with reps, right? And
I think it also helps when in that apprenticeship, when you see somebody that you respect, communicate that type of honesty that gives you the confidence to be transparent as well. Because the explanatory models that we use for our patients and to explain their pain, to describe their function or their movement or their pathology, their problem, they're so important. You know, something that I haven't talked a whole lot today about, I guess it's connoted in relationships, is how we communicate is so important. Sometimes those are the most important things that I've learned from my mentors or from apprenticeship experiences. It's just how someone communicates to someone else, and to do it in an effective and efficient way has been, I've picked up a few really great coaching cues from Brett Jones, and man, like I just, you know, I watched him coach a deadlift not too long ago, and I thought, wow, that guy's he's a genius. You know, like what a great opportunity it is to be around and learn from these people. And there's been a lot of sacrifices along the way for me to learn from these folks, for me and my family, but it's been worth it. I mean, it's just been so worth it for me.
Yeah, you talked about comfortable with silence. And I remember early in my radio career, I would almost script out what I was going to say when the song ended and I needed to talk. And then as things went on and I started training other people, I remember just thinking, wow, I'm totally cool with just being quiet for just 2 seconds and gathering my thoughts and then saying something rather than just ramble. But that took time because it's almost like flying without a net.
Absolutely.
So that's cool. I like that parting shot a lot. I'm digging that one. Again, you can check him out on Twitter at Don Regan, Donreagan. We definitely want to have him back on the show. I dug this a lot, man. He's out at Mountain River Physical Therapy at FMS headquarters in Virginia, and definitely do not want to see it to be the last time you're on the show.
Absolutely. Love to do it again. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pintcast and online at ptpintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.